Welcome to Hearing Voices, the best of public radio from NPR. I'm Larry Massett. Our show today is Vietnam Vets, which means, well, it means you may want to scoot the kids out of the room for the next couple of minutes, because we're about to play a piece of tape from 1972, recorded by some journalist in Vietnam. This is from a Folkway Records album called Good Morning, Vietnam.
Did he drop or what?
No, he's got to get the data before you got it.
Come here, son of a bitch. I want your ass.
Well, it goes on and on and on for several more years, in fact. The Vietnam War officially came to an end in 1975, the fall of Saigon. But of course, for the soldiers who had fought it, it didn't just stop then and there. The war was inside them, and it went on and on and on. Here is Scott Carrier talking with the writer and Vietnam vet, Douglas Peacock.
When Doug Peacock came home from Vietnam in 1968, he had trouble readjusting to society and ended up going off into the wilderness alone.
I was like a wounded animal in some ways and really probably didn't know it very much. I mean, I was no different than thousands of other vets. I didn't know.
So you went and lived by yourself?
Yeah.
And didn't have to talk to anybody?
No. Uh-uh.
But did you like that, living by yourself?
Yeah, I did. And I didn't have much of a plan, and I never thought about it very much, but I was completely comfortable by myself for a couple of years.
He became an expert on grizzly bears, living with them, filming them, writing books and magazine articles. He liked how he felt when he was around them. They helped him restore his sense of humanity.
You walk around with that in mind, you know, that you're not only out there with a dangerous animal, but you might be seen as prey. That awareness of being chow to another animal, it's been with human beings and their ancestors since, you know, the dawn of consciousness.
Peacock has recently published a book called Walking It Off, which is largely about his struggles with post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. He's an expert on this, as well as grizzly bears, so I asked him to talk about it.
Do you understand what PTSD is?
Well,
what is it?
You know, my understanding is not technical or medical. It just, it can be a fear of your own death. In my case, it was watching children get killed, suffer and die. It was seeing too many people destroyed, civilians destroyed by the war.
I should explain that Peacock was a Green Beret medic stationed in a mountain outpost in Quang Nai province near My Lai. This was a very active zone during the Tet Offensive, and he ended up witnessing a massacre of the people in his village, and then having to attend to the wounded.
180 civilians were caught in the crossfires in my last days in Vietnam. I was the only American not in the A camp, and somebody called in airstrikes. I couldn't stop it. And 180 civilians, almost all women and children, you know, were caught in this crossfire. And that's what I did in the last 4 days. I was in the field in Vietnam. And you see part of your life, you know, like you expected to live your life, you know, when you were going to high school or going to college, and you kind of imagine these possibilities, you know, sort of a normal, comfortable, middle-class life. You just see that as gone. It's just chopped off like an amputation, you know, like a finger or thumb or a foot. And, you know, you mourn the loss, but you never really try to get it back. Those doors are closed.
It's been a long road for Peacock, some of it good, some of it not so good. Now he tries to stay in touch with other vets and current soldiers who are going through the same thing.
I've been getting correspondences from a few soldiers in Iraq, and it's a horrible war. I feel lucky having fought in Vietnam. At least I had the jungle to retreat into. At least I spoke the language. I had friends that were mountain yards, that were Vietnamese. These guys, they're in their compounds, you know, with their barbed wire and their, you know, their guards and little cities and artificial little green zones, you know, with air conditioning and movies, and they drive out into this incomprehensible horror, you know, where death just reaches for them unseen, and you know. Never perceived, never understood. It has no face.
What do you think about the stories now about the killings of civilians by the Marines
in
different places?
Yeah, I'm sort of surprised it hasn't happened more often. I think it's a testimony to decent leadership that it hasn't happened more. And I'm talking about the military leadership, you know, the middle military leadership, the captains and the sergeants and the lieutenants, because, you know, at the top, you know, what has made atrocity possible again is, I think, is the attitude of the, you know, the administration. It's immoral, it's lawless, and, you know, the stuff they call post-traumatic stress, you know, in my experience, it really emerges from wars that are, you know, unjust, unwinnable, you know, or maybe even immoral. And I'm surprised it hasn't happened more often.
When it does happen, what are the soldiers thinking? What are they doing? Do you know?
They're falling back on the most, you know, on the basis of their training, which trains them to kill. It's good training. That's how you survive. You kill. But you cannot get into that kind of position where you shoot babies and sleeping people and still feel they're human beings. You have to make that separation. And obviously, to the Marines, the Iraqi civilians are not human beings. You execute them like you would pigs or sheep or something like that. And that's what happened to Milai, too. These people, they are able to maybe look at their buddies and see humanity, but the rest of the world isn't there, and the people that they're shooting are not fully human.
What would you tell guys coming back from Iraq who've had these type of experiences where they've either killed civilians or seen civilians die?
Even though every kind of logic you're capable of says that your particular experience was so unique that you can't imagine anybody like you. And you're right. You're correct about that. But at the same time, you know, there's thousands of people out there that are going through in a very private fashion the same thing you're going through. You're not really as isolated as you think you may be. And, you know, it'll take them a long time to tell their stories. But that's the most healing of all to, you know, in a collective kind of way, is to, you know, begin to share those stories. And I think the world right now needs the story of those journeys, you know, the journey to the underground, really, you know, to the horrors of war. I mean, they need the stories of those returning veterans.
Doug Peacock's latest book is Walking It Off, A Veteran's Chronicle of War and Wilderness. Scott Carrier teaches journalism at Utah Valley University in Orem, uvu.org. Got on a plane.
My younger brother calls me a killer and my daddy calls me a vet. Everybody says I'm someone else, that I'm sick and there's no cure. Damned if I know who I am. There was only one place I was sure when I was still in Saigon. Still in Saigon.
Charlie Daniels Band, Still in Saigon. You're listening to Vietnam Vets on Hearing Voices.
Still in Saigon.
My neighbor Rich Kepler seems like a regular guy. A wife, two kids, a dog, a cat, house with a yard. Nothing unusual, except one day he happened to mention he writes poems. Lots of them. Never published. A hobby, huh? So I asked him to read me a couple. I thought maybe I was going to hear doggerel about, you know, the moon in June. I don't know what I was expecting. Certainly not this.
Oh, my God. What do I do? What do I read? Well, the first one on the top here is a poem that I wrote in 1966. It's about in Buffalo, New York, in the early, early fall, sometimes it will snow before the leaves are off the trees. It's always incongruent because it doesn't seem right that the leaves should be laden with all that snow, and it just doesn't seem right. And consequently, I got my draft notice in September 1966 on a day just about when the snow in Buffalo came across the Great Lakes and laden the trees. So I always thought that that was too soon, and I thought it was too soon for the boys to be drafted as well. So that's what this is about. It's snow on the leaves, not yet off the trees. Buffalo, New York, 1966. Today, all over this blue-collar town, selective service draft notices are being dropped into mailboxes for the young boys as an unexpected cold front charges over the warm water of Lake Erie. Moist air lifts into the cold wind as peach-fuzzed faces play ball behind Holy Angels School. The boys posture for the pretty girls who cling to the chain-link fence, sweet and mysterious. All the boys want a first car and a job at the mill next year. The stamping plant is hiring now. Slick back your hair and go cruising. The Del Shannon Show is on WKBW radio. And Vietnam is somewhere far away as snow begins to fall in Buffalo and the leaves not yet off the trees. Vietnam, huh? Wow. I'll read you Huey's, 1967. This is a year after. I was a medevac medic, 1st Infantry Division, and we flew on gunships, and those helicopters never really seemed right, you know. I could understand great engines pushing forward and air bending over long wings, creating massive lift over clouds into thin air as we flew over oceans and continents with ease and assurance, Playboy magazines on our lap. But whirling blades over a hostile jungle canopy, in the middle of someone else's civil war, a single motor, open doors, a 21-year-old warrant officer driving, stoned on hashish, in a monsooned blackened night, lost and laughing, well, it just seemed a little iffy to me. Free fire zone. So terrified and alone they were, patrolling the free fire zone. If the wind blew, they shot trees until they fell in a heap. A cow and a pig too. Anything that moved. And so it was for the silhouette that carried a rake and a hoe. I was sent to Germany. They put me in med-surg and the burns unit, and my guys that I left were being killed, and I always felt like either I cheated them or I cheated myself. I felt guilty for leaving them. Part of what I had to do was to process the dead bodies. And so I wrote a poem about this fellow. His name was Sergeant Graves. That was his actual name, Sergeant Graves. I sat and watched after you died in that Army hospital. It was just you and I, Sergeant Graves, and the resuscitation machine sloshing back and forth. It still expanded and contracted your dead chest. I wondered a lot of things about you, Sergeant Graves, as I tagged your right toe. Mostly, I wondered if you still had those three Clark bars in your top drawer. They were there, Sergeant Graves, they were there. And I was eating the last one as I slid you into the dark refrigerator. So when I got out of the service, I was doing too many drugs and everything was bothering me. And I was a hospital technician because I had this medical training. And I got mononucleosis, and the doctors there, the nurses told me, you can't come to work, you're too sick. But that didn't stop me from going to the bars every night and drinking, coming home and smoking pot and whatever drug I could find. And one night I fell in a hole coming home and I broke my ankle. So now I had a broken ankle, a cast up to my knee, and I had mononucleosis. And I was drinking every night. I was hopping all over College Park, Maryland, closing the bars. So one night I came home and I was just so exhausted and fell down in my bed. And about an hour later, about 4 o'clock in the morning, I woke up with a searing pain going down my left arm. Your spleen gets enlarged when you have mononucleosis and you can rupture your spleen. You have to take care of yourself. Maybe I was trying to kill myself. I don't know. So I felt this terrible, terrible, terrific, terrific pain going down my left arm. It dawned on me that maybe my spleen had ruptured. Just as soon as I thought that, I fell into my bookcase and I knocked my bookcase over. And I was too dizzy, I couldn't stand up. So I started doing a low crawl and I started hallucinating about that I was in the Army, I was low crawling. And I thought I was being chased. I thought maybe the Viet Cong were chasing me. And someone woke up in the morning around 5 o'clock, 5:30, and saw me in the hallway. And I was just white as a sheet, and I was barely conscious. And this friend of mine called an ambulance, and they came and they took me to my very emergency room where I worked. The nurses and the doctors that I worked with saw me come in, you know, and they went, oh my Lord, what has he done now? Look at him. And they rushed me up to the OR. I remember watching that, and I was on a stretcher, and I watched the fluorescent lights go boom, 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 boom. I was totally ambivalent about this living thing. I thought, this would just be fine for me if I could just get out of this whole thing. I really don't care. Boom, 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 boom. And it's funny, after something like that happens to you, you're almost set free. I knew then at that point, after I got well, it took me about a year to be able to stand up straight. But I knew I didn't have to be a businessman then. I didn't know I didn't have to be successful. I knew I didn't have to do anything I didn't want to do, because I was on the sixth ball on the pinball game. You know, I got an extra ball. But remember how angry I was for years after I got out of the Army. I was just mad. And I was mad at everybody. And when I got to be 50 on my birthday, I didn't feel angry anymore, thank goodness. At least not angry like I used to. And so I wrote this poem, Angry Young Men. Angry young men are not sure why they boil inside, grinding souls wanting to punch something. Maybe it's third down and long with your father watching, or the cult of violence on the screen, or the thankless wars we send them to. Perhaps it's simply the veil of tears that never really fall down their cheeks. Or something so simple as bad hormones mixed with too much cheap beer. But my advice, if ever you feel an angry young man coming towards you, get out of his way. Like a cold wind, he will go right through you and not look back. I have hit people, and I don't remember who they were or exactly why, but that was long ago, back when I couldn't cry. I'm 50 now, and I cry all the time.
Hearing Voices will be back in just a minute.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
Welcome back to Vietnam Vets on Hearing Voices. Here's another shortcut from that 1972 Folkways album, Good Morning Vietnam, recorded by Claude Jonner. This one is labeled Everyday Life in the Country.
I'm Malik Edwards from Phoenix, Louisiana. I served in Vietnam as a PFC with the 1st Battalion, 9th Marines in Da Nang.
My name is Robert Holcomb, and I was drafted into the Army in 1968 and actually did not go until 1969.
I'm Robert Mountain from Millen, Georgia, 25th Infantry Division, Kuchi, Dao Tiang.
My name is Harold Lightbull Bryan. I'm from East St. Louis, Illinois. I was a combat engineer in the 1st Cavalry Division in Anhui, Vietnam from 1966 to 1967.
I'm Colonel Fred V. Cherry, United States Air Force, retired. And I'm subject of 7.5 years as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam.
These are some of the soldiers who talked to the journalist Wallace Terry for his 1984 book, Bloods, an oral history of the Vietnam War by black veterans. These are their stories.
I think of Vietnam almost every day. I don't know exactly what it is that triggers it, but it may be something that I may see walking down the street, a feeling, a smell, a sight. I don't know. Maybe it's because that at that time, being a 19-year-old kid, that Vietnam was really the biggest event that ever happened to my life.
When we went in, they treated us real nice in the recruiting station. And so then they took us to San Diego. And the closer we got to San Diego, I noticed people's attitudes started to change toward us. So they took us down this dark road. And then they pulled us into this little, Spanish-style courtyard. And it was, dimly lit. And the truck sort of, backed in. And they came out and they started screaming and yelling, "Everybody out!" And, it was like terror. I can say only a few times I've been terrorized in my life. That was probably one of the major traumas in my life. Is when they told us to put, they had these yellow footprints printed in in four ranks. And you had to put your feet on these footprints, put your thumbs along the seam of your trousers, your head and eyes straight to the front. You don't talk, you don't move, and the first and last word out of your mouth is sir.
Boot camp for me was very strenuous. I have a very small frame. I was unable to run in the big boots successfully and to carry the heavy packs on my shoulders. However, after being there for 4 or 5 weeks of continuous training, I became conditioned.
It just got real unreal after a while. These guys were just screaming and hollering. And you know how they talk, "Oh, you dumb piece of shit, your ass over here." You know, that whole tone of voice, it was like, wow, man, these guys are nuts. Of course, in those days, they called you Brillo Head and Tar Baby, and they will use the magic word, the big N.
I did not know at the time, but the military brainwashed me. I became an American fighting man. I actually wanted to shoot a Vietnamese to see what he looked like when he fell, because I had played so many war games.
Where I got introduced to Vietnam is when I was at Camp Pendleton, and I was in the Delta Company 3-1, 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines. And the Cuban target, we were using Cuban targets when I went in. And then the targets were changed over to Vietnamese targets. And so then we started getting the idea that we may be going to Vietnam. First of all, you was going on a patrol if you was black, okay? You know you was going to be out there at night. It's just how many was going to go that night and who was going to get picked, because you knew somebody was going.
I was with a column of about 10 tanks and tracks, and we were cutting a trail in Cambodia, and as we were cutting the trail, we ran into some contact and a firefight broke out, and there was just an immense amount of noise, so I turned around to my rear, since I was the last person, and began to spray the rear with my M60 machine gun, just in case someone was sneaking up from the rear to attack us, I would wipe them out before they could really get to us. And in the midst of doing that and all of the noise, when I turned around after protecting our rear, I noticed that all of the tracks and tanks had pulled off the trail, and I didn't know where they were. And I was absolutely terrified, because I was thinking that now I'm left on this trail in Cambodia, and I have no map, I have no food, and all I have is this machine gun and a lot of rounds. What I did, I crawled to the side of the trail and out of sight of anybody, and began to try to move in the direction that I thought our unit was in. And as I proceeded to, I noticed some movement, and I recognized that our men were not far from me. So what I did, I began to creep closer to them cautiously, though, so that I didn't make any noise and didn't excite them at all, because if they did notice some movement there, more than likely they turn around and just spray the area, and then there I am, and I could get killed. So I got as close as I could, and then I actually called out to them and let them know that I was there. Of course, they swung their weapons around immediately, but once they heard it was me and saw it was me, they then relaxed, and then I ran over and caught up with them, and that ended that situation.
Well, we kind of call it the curse of the Ninth Marines, I guess. Well, to the black guys, that's what it was. As each one of the battalions landed the first night, a black person was killed. And that black person was killed by a friendly fire each time. And it was like, whew, you know, to think about that, you know, it kind of conjures up a whole lot of other stuff. I guess I probably hadn't even thought about this in this way for a while. It's a trip. You know, it was more fear coming back into the lines than it was going out. Because you could get killed faster coming back than you could on a patrol. Because night in Vietnam was that's when things, I mean, that's when things happened. You know, at night, that's when we did most of our serious patrolling was late at night, because you don't want the Vietnamese to be able to sneak up on you. And coming back in the line, you know, it was, white guys had this joke that, you know, it's hard to see you guys if your eyes are not open and I can't see your teeth. You know, I mean, it would say stuff like that. Of course, a lot of these things would lead to serious brawls depending on what the rank was. And sometimes you really had to grin and bear it.
Well, there was a guy in our platoon who let it be known that he was a card-carrying KKK man, which none of us really dug. But one day, out in the bush, Mr. Ku Klux Klan got caught out in a rice paddy in the middle of a firefight. And the VC was just really shooting at him. They really couldn't see him because he was hid behind a dike. So all of us, we laid down a base of fire to try and cover him, relieve some of the pressure off of him. And one of the Bloods went out there and pulled him back. And after that incident, Mr. Ku Klux Klan really changed his perception of what black people were all about changed, because he got to asking us different questions about that, about our lives as it compared to his. But I think it really was that firefight and us laying down a base of fire and covering his ass that saved him, and his whole perception of black people changed.
On December 28th, approximately 3 o'clock in the morning, when I woke, I found that I had been injured. My right hand was hurting very badly, and I looked down to discover that two fingers were missing. Immediately, I rolled over to my stomach to try to crawl into the bunker. When I pushed with my left foot, there was this excruciating pain. However, I did pull myself in the bunker. Later, I found that all of the bones had been shattered in my foot by a rocket grenade launcher, and resulted in an amputation at the ankle level.
Being in the combat zone, James Plummer and I got to be pretty close friends. He was a John Coltrane fan. He kind of not necessarily introduced me to John Coltrane, but he made me pay a little bit more attention to John Coltrane. And I'm being a Miles Davis fan. We just naturally got together, and our general conversation would always drift to music. Plummer and I got tight generally because of music and because of Miles and Train. Out there in the bush, we were doing some work. Matter of fact, we were building an airfield. And being in the combat engineers, one of the units had dug an ammo dump, and we were dumping all our spare ammo in that dump. And Plummer happened to have been over there one day, and the ammo dump received a live mortar round, and the ammo dump went off, and Plummer happened to have been there. And the... he got killed, and it wasn't anything left for us to put in a body bag to send back to his mother. I dug James Plummer, and I still like John Coltrane. And whenever I hear Train, I think of Plummer.
The day that I was shot down, October 22nd, 1965, I took off from Tok Lee, Thailand. I was leading a flight of 4 aircraft, and my target was a surface-to-air missile installation just outside of Hanoi. I had been flying missions over North Vietnam prior to the day that I was shot down. I was something over 50, mid-50s, and I always felt invincible. No one could knock me out of the sky, you know. Had that kind of confidence. So when I was captured, and the planning that we had done prior to engaging in the war in North Vietnam, the thing went through my mind, you know, damn, I'll be here a while. Now this while was like 1 to 3 months in my mind. But my 1 to 3 months turned out to be 7.5 years. Well, the first camp I was put into was the Wallow Prison, which we call Hanoi Hilton initially. If it weren't direct torture, you were mentally being tortured almost every day of the year that we spent there. But the in my particular case, I was tortured for 93 days straight. That included 3 beatings a day, with sometime with fan belts or sometime with bamboo. They realized I was the first black they had, I was the senior black they had, and if they could get me to make tapes denouncing the war, denouncing the U.S. government and our involvement in the war, it would be very, very helpful to them, and they were willing to get that information at almost any cost, at the physical expense, which included the 93 days of torture and many in-between light tortures and beatings. But I always refused to make any tapes or write anything that was against the war or against the U.S. government. I just never did it. And I told him, I finally got to the point that I wouldn't do it, and if they had to kill me for not doing it, then that's what they'd have to do, because I'd made up my mind I wasn't going to do it. I had to, being the only black, the senior one, had I done that and disgraced myself, all other black Americans, all those in the South, those in this country, that even if I came out alive, I couldn't live with myself. So I had a lot, I felt I had a whole lot that I had to protect at whatever cost. And that was my service, my uniform, my country, 23 million black folks, and myself, and my family. So I just had a lot at stake.
Of course, that scared everybody when Milaya came back. We were wondering if they wanted to go back to Vietnam digging up on everybody, because Milaya wasn't the only time that happened. I mean, it was just the way you fought that war, because the Vietnamese were some very tricky people. I mean, it wasn't like a bunch of little chumps that you just go in and push them around. I mean, they were serious. They were very cunning. They knew the land. I mean, they can sneak up. They have so many ways to do you. So your thing was, you know, zap them before you get zapped.
One incident I remember that happened shortly after I came in country, there was some milk that we had to get rid of, dispose of, because of the fact that it had spoiled because it was so hot there. Milk would only keep maybe a day or two at the most. And instead of just throwing it away, the soldiers that were assigned the job of getting rid of the milk, they began to throw this spoiled milk at a lot of people riding on these little moped motorcycles and Lambrettas. And, of course, the spoiled milk would hit the people and burst and get all over them. And it was just a very hostile thing to do. It was incidents like that, not only the incidents of soldiers maybe raping women, you know, due to frustration or whatever, or just being hostile to kids or to girls that would come over and try to sell them things like fruit and bananas and things of that nature. They'd still be hostile to them, mainly because they felt isolated and were uptight because of the fact that they were in a foreign country and everything was unfamiliar and they were uncomfortable. So in order to take out anxieties, nothing would have been better for them to do a Vietnamese person in, not necessarily killing them, but just doing things to them that would just be outwardly hostile.
Man, Cam Nee, man. When we went into Cam Nee, this is 65, first of all, we were told about the operation. We were told that they were going to send in the helicopters with the speakers and drop flyers telling the people that we were coming through and that they should leave the village. Because the sweep, well, we wouldn't just go in there sweeping. We would sort of send out the warning crew, you know, telling in Vietnamese, telling the Vietnamese to leave. And they said, well, anybody else in there, you know, is Vietnamese. And if we receive one round from the village, you level it. So I was in the Amtrak with Maury Safer. and the reporters, because they were going out on the patrol with us. And I kind of told them, they laughed at me and said, what are you guys doing? So I told them what our orders were, because I thought that was real hip, you know. It was so bad that if you shoot us, we're going to kill everybody. You know, I kind of like supported that view at the time. I was a young kid. I was a Marine. I thought like Marines thought, at least up to that point. And so not only did we receive one round, but one of our favorite people got killed. One of the few black staff sergeants, Sergeant Bradford, who we love with a passion, all the brothers, white guys love. So we kind of, and the other guy that got wounded was another guy that was one of our favorites. So three people got wounded, and two of them was like favorite people in the company. Whoa. So we received a shot, first of all, and this is a strange thing that happened, right? So I'm going across, we're moving into the village, right? And I run up on this bamboo snake that is the most feared snake in Vietnam, almost with one hand. And it's small. I mean, I shot the snake head off. It just like blew my mind that I did it. So then when we received around, this old man started running. He said, get him, Edwards. I turned him. I couldn't even hit him. I mean, here a minute ago, I'm blowing away this snake. You know, this little, it's only less than an inch with a head, less than an inch wide from my hip. But I'm aiming, and I can't hit this old guy. So he runs into this building. So another guy comes up, and he fires his M79 into this building. Well, he caught the old man as he came in. He caught him and hit him in the stomach, cut him in half. Well, what the old man was doing, he was going back to warn the kids in this classroom that we were coming and to get to safety. And it, like, really freaked the guy out that did it. It just blew his mind and blew my mind.
Being out on patrol and constantly being out the bush all the time, we would always run into skirmishes. And there was a lot of guys whose constant habit was taking ears as a body count. You know, we'd take the ears and we'd take them and wrap them around their dog chains. And be out there in the bush with their ears around there, wrapped on their dog chains, or a rope around their neck, or some guys would stick them in their pockets. It got to be almost a common thing that you would see guys, but we kind of cooled that out, because when we go back to base camp, guys would nail those ears up on the hooch, and after 2 or 3 days, those ears would start stinking, and we just outlawed it. We've seen guys just mutilate bodies, even though an individual was dead, and he was, you know, the enemy was dead, they would go in through a mutilation process of just trying to kill him even more, just taking their aggression out on that.
This guy ran up on me. And I saw something behind me. I couldn't really tell what it was. And next thing I know, there was this guy running right up in my face with his hands up in the air. Well, you know, I just turned around and started shooting. So anyway, I killed him. Well, I didn't kill him right away. He was sort of like laying there moaning, and I could not deal with this sound. The weirdest sound in the world to me is a person moaning at the edge of death. So I said, man, let me put him out of his misery, because I could not stand the sound this guy was making. So I just shot him in the head. So when he ran up on me, I hit him so many times, he was like really torn apart. And he probably would have died anyway. I'm sure he would have died anyway, because, I mean, he was cut in half and his arm was hanging off and all that stuff. So then I had to drag this body back. He told me I had to drag him back. I said, hey, man, I killed him. I'm going to drag him back. Because in them days, we didn't have the body count, so we couldn't just leave him there. We had to bring him back. You know, I'm dragging this guy down this. And it's really hard to drag a body on a rice paddy dike. You know, it's a very narrow pathway, and it was raining, and it was like, it's just weird. And here I'm dragging this guy. Nobody would even help me with him, right? And I'm dragging the guy, his arm falls off. Now I got to go get his arm and pick up his arm up and put it down in his underwear so it won't fall all over the place. It's so wild, man. So then we come back, you know, we're coming in, the word is back, we're bringing in the body. Edmiston killed this guy, you know, everybody's all cheering me, I'm dragging this human behind me. And all of a sudden I realize this man has, is he of a son? Does he have a family? Is he a human being? Thou shalt not kill. All of that stuff came down on me. And nobody to turn to and to tell how I feel. Everybody's patting me on the back. Hey, Killer Ed, man. I am just like freaking out. But I can't show it. Because to show it, and man, I wasn't a Marine.
By the time I got home and had gotten the courage to actually put on civilian clothes since I had gotten so comfortable wearing the military garb. Went home to my parents' house in Gary, Indiana, and I decided I was going to stay there with them for a month or two and rest and recuperate, and then from there I'd move to New York or wherever else I had planned on going. But the first night when I was there, my parents were so happy to see me, so they had made my bed up in my room upstairs in the house then, and just had everything set up perfectly and had a very good dinner and so forth. But when I got ready to go to sleep the first night, I got in the bed and I tossed and turned all night. I just couldn't sleep in a bed. I hadn't slept in a bed in a long time, a year. And so what I had to do was actually move all of my belongings, my bed and everything, downstairs in the basement to a corner and to some degree recreate the type of living arrangements I had living in the jungle and in the field in Vietnam. And the idea there was to create a little safe haven for yourself. You dig a little shallow grave to lay in to sleep, and you position all of your belongings around you, your pistol here, your M16 there, your grenades here, your radio here, your and other paraphernalia and stuff that you wanted to eat, drink, or consume right next to you. So I felt comfortable after I had moved into the basement. And the other thing about it was that I was below ground, and I felt safer being below ground than I did being above ground and exposed.
And then when you came back home and you had to deal with the kind of humiliation and contempt that the country had for you, it kind of blew our minds, because I remember my cousins and uncles coming home from Korea, how we greeted them. You know, everybody was so happy to see them, and our boys were home, and, you know, we got it from our families, because my family met me with open arms and just greeted me with so much love and understanding.
When I returned home, some people knew that I had been in the military and had gone to Vietnam and was issued, but the majority of the people would ask, how did you lose your leg? Were you in an automobile accident? Was it surgically removed because of some disease? When they found that I had been to Vietnam, a lot of people would ask, why? You shouldn't have gone. I returned to college approximately 45 days after being discharged from the military, and much to my dismay, a lot of students really gave me hell. They talked about the prosthesis that I wore because it was very big and bulky at the ankle. They noticed that I had a slight limp, and more so than that, they talked about the girls that I dated, so much so that one girl that I really liked discontinued dating me, and she told me that was the reason why.
You know, like the day people say they're now forgiving the Vietnam veterans and they're accepting us. Wrong. Why should we have to go through that? We was doing it for the country. We wasn't going over there because we felt like having a war. They're like the Vietnam veterans say, hey, let's go to war. Let's go over to Vietnam and have a war. We didn't say that. Matter of fact, if it was left to us, we wouldn't have went.
The ammo dump received a live mortar round, and the ammo dump went off, and Plummer happened to have been there. And he got killed. And it wasn't anything left for us to put in a body bag to send back to his mother. I dug James Plummer, and I still like John Coltrane. And whenever I hear train, I think of Plummer.
You've been listening to the voices of Harold Bryant, Malik Edwards, Fred Cherry, Robert Holcomb, and Robert Mountain talking to the writer Wallace Terry for his book Bloods, an oral history of the Vietnam War by black veterans. Terry died in 2003. The piece was produced by Katie Davis and edited by Gary Covino. I'm Larry Massett for HearingVoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darham. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of SoundImagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.